From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn, our technical director, Kyle Mabry, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Well, today we open the phone lines for questions about computers. This is a topic we take up once a month on the first Thursday of the month. Whether you're looking for a new computer, have questions about online security, or need some troubleshooting advice, Debbie Fleiger and Jim Eyrick are ready to help. Debbie is a network engineer for Sites. That's the acronym for Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services at the University of Illinois. Jim is a security engineer for NCSA, the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois. Listeners, join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Jim, Debbie, good to see you again. How are you?
Okay, you?
Very good.
Yeah, I'm fine. So, what should we talk about here? No one waiting for us at the moment. I was thinking maybe have either one of you seen the new iPad? And is it all it's said to be?
I know we've got two on order for our group at the university to use for testing things. You know, when things don't work, we have to be able to test them. But no, I haven't seen them yet. They're not here yet.
You're such an Apple person. I thought you would have taken a look.
Well, yeah, but if I look at it, I'm going to want one.
I know.
My budget doesn't include a new iPad this year.
Well, are your friends and coworkers saying anything about it?
I have one coworker that has one. Yeah. I haven't really talked to him about it. Yeah. As we talked before, I'm not really a tablet person. So,
yeah.
I mean, he has it. The screen looks nice. He says it looks really great on the applications that have been rewritten for the new resolution. I think he actually made a comment that it makes some of the older apps actually look worse.
Uh-huh.
But once they refresh them, it should be fine.
Yeah. Speaking of apps, you know, I have an iPad, iPad 2, and the apps, the App Store will let you know if there have been updates and that kind of thing. But what if I don't want to update something? What if I don't like the changes they've made to an app? How can I get rid of that thing that keeps telling me that you can update this or you should update this?
Boy, I don't know if you can tell it to not show you that there's an update,
mm-hmm.
but you don't have to take the update.
Yeah.
Although once you do take the update, there's not very easy to back out.
There's no going back?
No, not really.
Maybe if you have a backup of it on your desktop, you might be able to figure something out. But they certainly, there's no instructions on Apple's website, I bet.
Yeah, usually if the vendor releases an updated version, there's a reason they want you to run it. Either they've updated it for a bug, or they've updated it for a new feature, or they've made it support the newer version of iOS. When the iOS for the iPad, the new iPad came out, I had a flurry of apps that needed to be updated because they released a new iOS recently, you know, and there were things that just didn't work until you updated them. So for the most part,
yes,
you want them.
Right, right. There is a game, though, that I like to play, and I like the way it is. I don't want to go to the new thing, which has, they've incorporated butterflies and spiders in it. And it's like, no, just leave it alone.
Some of the vendors are nice enough to give you a checkbox someplace that says, you know, use the old interface.
Oh, okay. So but maybe I can look into that.
Yeah, maybe you could still update it and have a turn off the new features.
Okay. Very good.
Get rid of the spiders and butterflies.
Yes, please. Yeah.
You can always also provide feedback in the reviews. Or to the vendor that, hey, I don't want this part. If you don't have a checkbox for me to turn it off, could you add one?
Yeah. Most things I do update because they're better. They fix some bugs and that kind of thing. But occasionally it's like, leave it alone. I like it the way it is. This is Focus, and we're talking about computers this morning with Debbie Fleiger and Jim Eyrick of the University of Illinois. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And I'm wondering, anything new in regard to the new operating systems coming from Apple and Microsoft in the very near future? We talked a little bit about that last time.
We have a box. We have a virtual machine running testing Windows 8, but I have not gone in and played with it. Somebody else is in my group, so I don't know where that's going.
And has that person said anything?
Yeah, I haven't asked them about it.
Yeah,
no.
Okay.
So they've made a lot of changes. Again, I think we talked last time that some of the changes seem to make it more tablet touch-friendly things, and I'm not a big fan.
You're not a tablet guy.
Yeah. So we'll see where that goes. It's funny, though, is every once in a while, even if I work on a tablet with a keyboard on it for a little while, which I have one, and I play with it sometimes, and so some things it's just easier to touch a screen and do it than use the mouse or the keys, and then I switch back to a big laptop, and then I'm like, I poke the screen, and I'm like, oh, wait.
Wait, that doesn't work.
So maybe that'd be all right, but we'll see.
Yeah. Are touch screens going to come to desktops? That seems like a
I think IBM
natural.
Just made a comment about that this week, or Intel maybe, that they thought one of the manufacturers actually made a comment about that they thought the future of laptops was basically tablets with keyboards, clamshell tablets with touchscreens. So I guess it depends what the cost, how much it adds to each device, and eventually when that's low enough, they'll just put it on there whether you use it or not, I suspect.
I would agree with that, but I'd say the big thing now is one of the reasons tablets are the size they are is it's expensive to get a working touchscreen of large size. You know, people put them in kiosks, and you know, you might have them other places like that, but the reason you don't see them everywhere and on desktops and in notebooks is they're too expensive for what you get for most applications. It's if the price comes down, you would see them more.
Yeah, very interesting. I think that would be great. It seems it touch is very intuitive, right? I mean, it's very human.
Yeah, there's also, I think for somebody that's sitting at a desk doing office style, I'm not sure what you have to consider the ergonomics. I had to go to a marble instead of a mouse that you move with your whole arm, just a marble that I move with my thumb because I was having problems, mm-hmm. basically kind of like a tennis elbow. And I consider things like, is it good to make somebody lift their arm up off the desk to touch their screen, if there's repetitive stress problems there, mm-hmm. movement problems. And the other issue is, do I really want fingerprints all over my monitor at work?
True, true. And I suppose the other thing is, when you think about the tablet, if you're going to be doing work on it, like writing, it is probably better to go with a keyboard, a wireless keyboard, something like that, to make it easier on your fingers and just make it easier.
So you can get some today. Wacom, a very well-known tablet maker, for doing graphics input, sells a interactive pen display. So it's like a 24-inch HD monitor that you use a pen on, and it's got a special stand so that it's held at the right angle and the right height. But for a 24-inch display, that runs you $2,600. That's a lot more than you'd pay for just a display. But you could buy it if it's useful to what you do. And for some graphics artists, it's like the perfect tool and it's worth the money.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about voice for these devices that we're so fond of, whether it be desktop, laptop, tablet? Coming? I mean, we've got Siri.
Well, yeah. The Siri on the
iPhones.
But there's been things like, since I've been playing with computers, we've been talking about talking to computers, and I had one where you could dictate to it for doing documents, and it can never do it as fast or as accurate as I can just type it. So I don't know, as far as mainstream every person user kind of deal, if there's actually a need there, or where people, it's cool when you see it on TV on the advertisements,
mm-hmm.
on whether you actually end up using it and it works in a way that you find useful as opposed to frustrating. The other issue is, again, there's a lot of PCs. I mean, a lot of the market, things like, for Microsoft's operating systems, people that pay full price for the professional versions and the Microsoft Office are in enterprise. Do you need an office full of people talking to their computer, and what kind of environment will that be? So
it'll be interesting to see as the university switches over to the unified communication, the link system, which is the new phone system, if that will change, because that has a voice recognition component to it. And I haven't had any experience with it, but anyway.
Well, it is. I have. And other, so I, my personal voicemail for my cell phone and also my voicemail at work now, both are sent through voice recognition systems, not the same one. One's Link and one's actually Google's voice stuff. And so it does voice recognition and then emails me the translation. And it is quite humorous. It's nice enough to usually get whether or not you need to call the person immediately back. But some of the things that it comes up with are very funny.
Amazing.
So what is it going to do when I'm talking to it and it's writing it as an email? You better read it very closely before you hit or tell it to send.
Okay. Well, let's take a call and talk with someone who is here with us and not leaving a message. Line 4, Champagne. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about network paths on a PC. I'm using a Microsoft Access database on my home computer, and I was wondering, is it possible to connect through a VPN to a database that is stored somewhere else? Like, if I can connect through, I know I can connect to VPN through it, but then how do I enter the path and access to get to that database?
So the path would be, well, I mean, are you asking that you don't know how to tell the database where it is on the network at all? Or you want to...
Right. I mean, I know where it is. Like, let's say, sorry if I'm not being clear, but okay, let's say that I have, you know, my database on my computer on, you know, Drive C, documents, you know, folder, Microsoft Access, so-and-so, so-and-so.
I see.
All right, so now I've, you know, established a VPN connection to a server elsewhere, and, you know, I can open... You know, I can look at the database, but how do I mean, I can look at the files, but how do I establish that path to that database?
So, and I'm not, it's been a while since I've worked on network access databases at using Access. And so the best way to do it is that you actually, on whatever machine where the database resides, you actually take that file and you put it into not, and I'm not sure if Access can do this or not, but certainly something like Microsoft SQL Server or another database server. And that database server then presents itself as IP ports, TCP ports on your computer. And then you have the VPN connection and the remote machine, you tell it the IP address of whatever your where the database is, and the remote machine's database client software then directly connects to those ports that have been opened by the database software, the server software. So you have where the database is located, you have a database server running. And that's not a file that it's presenting it as. It's actually presenting it as an IP connected database. And then you have this VPN tunnel between two machines, and wherever the VPN client software is on the remote machine, then you tell it the IP address of the where the server is, and it automatically should know the network path goes across that VPN, or you have to tweak your network settings to do that, and it'll then establish communication with the database server.
Okay, yeah, I think I'll have to look into this further. This whole idea might be a little more
complicated. So, I mean, the other way is for like a strictly an Access database, is that's actually just a file, right, on your hard drive.
Exactly.
So you could possibly, depending on the amount of bandwidth and how reliable the VPN connection is, you could share that file or share the folder that file is in on the machine it's in, and then just use Windows file sharing networking to open that share from the remote machine, and then using Access on the remote machine to open that file. Now, that's going to be slower. That's going to be slower because the remote machine will most likely have to open that entire file up when you access it. Whereas with the database server, what you do is you present it with queries and it presents you with answers, and the entire database never has to transition the network unless you actually send a query to it that asks for the entire database back.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll look into those two options. Yeah, I'm kind of in the in the preliminary stages of looking into this, but I will look into those too, and thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Others are invited. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We also invite email questions, comments. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. And the numbers, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. I don't know if this is kind of a tangential question or goes right to the heart of this, but what can you tell me about remote computing? Like, let's say I have my tablet with me or my laptop and I want to talk to my computer at home or at work. I'm really unfamiliar with this, but I know it's possible, right?
Sure. There's two or three different ways you can do it. Most desktop operating systems have a built-in program from their vendor. So if you're talking about Microsoft or Apple, Linux does everything its own way, but there are ways to do it there as well. That you, if you've got their software, you can just connect back. And that software typically exists for tablets as well as for other for notebooks and things like that. Apple built it into, I think, OS 7, called built-in screen sharing, and Windows has something very similar. And their remote desktop software that you get in with is free. Apple sells theirs. They've dropped the price tremendously. But if you, they're a big full-featured version, whereas Windows remote desktop is it just comes
with it. It comes with it, although there is some restrictions on that with Windows 7. Certain versions of Windows 7 do not include the remote desktop feature.
Okay.
I know that the Professional and the Ultimate do. I think there's some issues with Home and Home Basic of whether or not you can actually do remote desktop into it.
So there's some free software. One of the most well-known is called VNC.
Okay.
And that software would be software that you'd run on your desktop. And then you'd have a VNC software on your tablet that would connect. You have to be very careful with it because it's also well-known to exploits. So you have to be sure you wrap it inside something secure, like an SSH connection or some.
Which is probably beyond most users on an iPad.
Well, what I was going to say is that for that you've got to be sure on your server, on your desktop end, you've got it set up that way, and then that you've got a client that does it. The client I use, iSSH, gives you an option to tunnel your VNC inside SSH. So the tablet side knows how to do it. You just have to set it up on the desktop side. I know for the iPad, there's a number of different programs out there that, and then there's also kind of two different approaches. One is a very simple screen sharing kind of approach, and another is full control of your desktop. You know, actually being able to run commands and not just, you know, have a remote mouse and click what you'd be able to click if you were sitting there with your mouse, but actually run commands like administrator commands and things like that in the background. So it depends a little bit on what you want to do. And then that's to get to your machine. And then the other option is, because you'd sent some links about this, I think, last time we didn't get to it. There's software that lets you access a remote server in the cloud that's not yours, but it's a Windows workspace that you get, that you have a login to and you can use. And I said the caveat with that is just like any other place in the cloud you're storing your data is there's no guarantee that you're the only one with access to that. So, you know, if you have a file with something secure in it and you're putting it on Dropbox or Box.net or something, you know, you make sure you've encrypted that. So if you're doing your company's work on one of these cloud desktops,
you should make sure you consult the IT department and find out what the policy is.
Oh yeah,
right. So to if you're working on a spreadsheet for your Christmas presents that you're sharing with your spouse, you know, don't worry about it. Right, that there's no big deal there. But if you're working with sensitive data, financial data,
proprietary
information, you know, those kinds of things, it's certainly at places like the university or credit card company, you know, credit card number, social security number, stuff like that. I almost guarantee your IT department will say, do not put that stuff up there, right? But it works just fine. You just have to be aware of what you're doing and make sure that you understand the risks you're taking.
And when we were talking about sharing desktops, There's a couple of, we talked about, you know, the ones that come with the Apple or you pay for on the Mac devices, and then the ones with Windows. Important thing to think on that is if it's at your home or your work, depending on your networking, certainly we'll talk about a home because almost everybody has it set up like this, which is where your home network uses private IPs, and then your router does what's called network address translation and to the one public IP address that your provider, your internet service provider gives you, assigned you. And when you have a remote desktop, in order to get to, let's say, from the coffee shop or from work to get to your remote desktop mm-hmm. at home, somehow you have to basically poke a hole through your router at home to get into there. And there are ways to do that. You have to go into your router and configure things called port forwarding, things like that. The other service you can go with is there are places on the web. There's a couple of companies on the web that what they do is you install their software on your desktop at home and you install your software on your laptop or your tablet, they have a tablet apps.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does, instead of poking the holes, because that's the holes have to be poked when you go from the outside in to your home network. What it does is that your home computer actually calls them, because it's easy to go from inside to outside at home. That's how everything you do on your home router works. Web surfing is from inside out. That works perfect. And so your home computer calls and establishes a connection with their servers. And then your tablet calls and establishes a connection with their servers. And either that connection always goes through their servers or through those two pieces of software, it's able to shortcut it then directly from your tablet to your home. But it makes it a lot easier where you don't have to have, basically, you don't have to have any networking knowledge to make that work.
Mm.
There are still concerns. Like, you know, Debbie brought up it, with the third-party solutions is you are entrusting that they don't have a security breach and somebody is then able to remote desktop in your machine. I have not heard of that before. That doesn't mean it's not happened. I've just not heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also concerns about if you poke the holes through your home firewall and do port forwarding to make this work, is then you need to make sure that your desktop PC is secure, at least when it comes to that particular service, the remote desktop service, because you have now exposed that particular service, or depending on how you set it up, maybe possibly your entire computer,
mm-hmm.
to all internet traffic that's scanning your IP address. And those scans happen constantly. There are bad actors on the internet that are always scanning IP addresses to find out what services desktops are running or servers are running, and then probing them to find out if it's running something that they can take advantage of. So you just have to, those are concerns
yeah.
to think about.
Yeah.
In general, I like the idea of not only are there places that host your docs like Box and Dropbox or Google Docs, so then you just work on this shared list of files or documents out in the cloud. You're not exposing your tablet or your home computer to the internet or to a third party. The other thing that has come up, you may have touched this, is that there's actually full remote desktop hosts on the internet. So instead of sharing your home desktop, you actually rent a desktop out in the internet. It's not a document storage location. It is a full, it's virtual on some server somewhere. But basically, to you, it looks like you're the same thing as remoting into a home computer. It's not going to have all your home stuff on it, but it's still a Windows or some other brand of operating system, probably not a Mac, but possibly Linux. Or Windows server, but it looks like Windows. It has the start button like Windows has until version 8, as far as I know. and then you can work on that. And again, you're not exposing any of your personal things. You're just using this one that's out in the cloud. Now, again, read the fine print.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing this for work, make sure it abides by the policies you have, and consider the fact that this information is somewhere else, not in your control. Read what the guarantees are from the company that you're paying the money for to see what can happen bad, or what legal things can happen to you, or what legal recourse is there if necessary. Now, one of the good things, if it's a well thought out service that they're selling you, is that it'll be backed up, which means we don't have to, if you have important information on this, you don't have to worry about your home laptops or your desktop's hard drive failing. is because it's out in the cloud, and it probably has automatic failovers and things like that. So if that piece, the particular piece of equipment you're using crashes, well, they have a backup of it, or even better, it's actually running live backup. So it just seamlessly switches over to it, and you don't even know that there was ever a problem. Yeah. So your data's, as far as loss, your data is probably more secure. Now, as far as the security of other people not seeing it, possibly less secure than your home computer if you're very diligent about making sure your home computer is kept patched and not full of adware and malware.
And I believe some of those server options have a free desktop support as well. You're going to get a more limited desktop that you can use remotely for free, and then pay for the fancier ones, higher uptime, more availability.
But read the fine print on the free one to make sure that the only reason it's free is because they're giving you a little taste so that you pay for the other one, and not so that you're agreeing to... I mean, you should understand that possibly if it's free, it's because something you're doing is being tracked, and they're selling your information. I paraphrase something I read about free things on the internet is, if it's free, you're the product being sold. So, Facebook and Google and the other people, it's free to you, but that's because they're gathering information about you and they're making money on selling your information.
No such thing as a free lunch.
That's right.
Those free iPhone apps or Android apps, they're full of ads, right? It's the same thing.
Or they collect your contact list and things like that.
Yeah, that brings up another question I have for Debbie about the tablet that I really enjoy so much working on, and just for, having fun, is that you go to a website, and let's see if I can get it back up and going. You go to a website, and at the top of of the site I'm on, which is today's right now, is the Washington Post, up above, it says, Debug console, 32 messages. And then you can, I don't know, you have one, so this is a two. I don't know if there's any difference at all. So I hit the thing that tells me what the messages are, what the problems are, and it gives me this long list of all kinds of technical stuff. So then I just usually, I go, okay, debug. And I'm thinking, well, what do I need to do this? Is this anything? Is this, as David Letterman say, is this something? Is this nothing? So,
My Safari on my iPad doesn't have that. So, I also don't do a lot with JavaScript.
It looks like it was mostly Java messages. So probably things that the page is trying to do that for some reason the iPad doesn't have that feature enabled.
Oh, okay.
Or can't do it. Yeah, maybe it's Java is trying to launch Flash.
It's all mumbo jumbo to me.
iOS devices don't have Flash, so maybe it's related to that.
Gotcha.
Without digging deeper into it, it'd be hard to tell.
Yeah, the
but as long as you can still read the article.
Yeah, that's not a problem. But there are some little boxes, Debbie, if you'll look, and they have the big, like a red box, and you think, is that anything to be concerned about? Probably
not. Well, the little boxes are just... For the person who's, it looks like somehow you turn debugging on. Debugging being somebody who's trying to develop a page and check and see how well it works. And so you're getting all the JavaScript errors.
That probably happen for everybody, but they don't get told about them. So if you turn off debugging,
you won't
see them anymore. Ignorance is bliss.
But yeah, but there's red boxes with X's and orange boxes with exclamation points. And those are trying to tell you how important those warnings are in terms of whether or not it's going to make your page work or not.
I see. So I really don't need to be worried.
No, but it's taking up a lot of space on a fairly small screen. So
okay. So
yeah, I'd go into settings
and get rid of that
and see if you can turn debugging off.
Okay. Very good. This is Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn. This morning we're talking about computers. This is a topic we take up once a month on the first Thursday of the month. Debbie Fleiger and Jim Irick of the University of Illinois are with us this morning. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. The phones have been so quiet this morning. Also, the email folder is empty at the moment. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. Will, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. More after a short break.
Economist Simon Johnson says bitter debates about the national debt date back to the earliest days of the Republic. On the next Fresh Air, Simon Johnson explores the meaning of the national debt and prospects for managing it. He's the co-author of the new book, White House Burning. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
You're tuned to Focus from Illinois Public Media on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. And coming up tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, we'll do our monthly program about dogs. Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel of the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana will be with us tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. This morning, we're talking about computers with Debbie Flieger and Jim Irick of the University of Illinois. If you'd like to join us, give us a call, 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. So we have an email question. Dear WILL, I use a Mac System X411 and had unlimited internet access a few weeks ago, but now it's intermittent. Our PC still has unlimited access. I don't know whether I have a bad airport card or should deal with the ISP. Nothing seems to have changed as far as the system setup. Thanks for your advice.
Well, X411 is hard to, because Mac OS 4 is very, very old at this point, and I don't think it stopped at 4.1.1, so that seems like an interesting...
February 12th of this year, there was an update to OS X 10.4.11, so perhaps that's...
4.11, that
could oh, okay.
4.11.
Yeah, 4.11. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
the print on the screen is tiny. And my eyes are aging.
And that was just a month and a half ago. So that would be my guess. Do we have to start with perhaps they shouldn't be running 10.4?
10.4 is the last version that supported a PowerPC. So if they happen to still have PowerPC hardware, that's the only thing they can be running.
But if you have an Intel,
please get something newer. There are a lot of fixes. They don't release very many patches for 4 at all. I'm surprised they released any because they'd said they wouldn't. It must have been a big security hole. So the airport card being flaky with a computer this old, because we are talking about something quite a few years old at this point, that's not unrealistic. If what you didn't say is how the PC and the Mac are both hooked in, but if they're both sharing the same internet connection and the PC's access is unrestricted and the Mac works sometimes, it's less likely to be your internet service provider. Because usually, not always, but usually... they don't restrict by individual device. Either your connection works or it doesn't. And if it works at least sometimes, it's not usually like they've somehow blocked that specific device because they thought it was causing a problem or something. So the airport card, if you just updated in the last month to the new OS 10.4.11, there could have been a change in that's causing the problem. Backing out's often possible but not always easy. You might check... forums to see if other people are reporting similar issues.
And list when you start searching, I would specifically have the search terms with what model of home router or access point you have, because that the problem could be specifically between the 10.4.11 update and a particular model of wireless home router. And so you might find a forum that says, oh yeah, 10.4.1 made it so my such and such model router didn't do wireless very well anymore. But if I go into the router and make this change, it fixes it.
All right. Well, it looks like 10.4.11 was released in 2007.
Oh, that's interesting. The page says last modified February 20, 2012.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean the OS came up. So that's probably not a recent change.
Okay.
So that update is probably not it. So the airport card, because it's probably an older computer, is not unrealistic. Did you make any other changes to your, you know, wireless access point or your router on purpose or on accident? Did something move? Because if you're talking about wireless connections, you know, you get a new piece of furniture and you put it in, you know, a bookcase with some metal in it. That's more likely at an office than it is at home to have a metal bookcase. But that goes between you and your computer and the wireless router. That will change tremendously how well it works. So those are a few different things to kind of keep in mind when you're trying to figure it out. But it's probably not the ISP.
Okay. Let's take a call now. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm not going to get an iPad until Celeste gets all her problems worked out.
Oh, you should get an iPad. They're great.
I'll just keep listening.
I'm always going to have problems, so go ahead.
Well, in my case, the whole thing's a mystery. My issue is in terms of security, you know, in terms of email. Was it true in terms of where some of these people can get in, let's say on Gmail server, and get into your email, or is that happens?
There has been. So there was previously, and it's not been very recent, there were some issues with the authentication or the way people were able to see other people's emails. I mean, and that breach was addressed, and I have not heard of anything recently on that.
Well,
it would be much simpler for somebody if you have chosen a poor password for somebody to access any, not just Gmail, but any email service out on the internet that you have, whether it be your internet provided by your internet service provider or by a third party like Google or Yahoo, would be if you had a terrible or an easily guessed password that's not very complicated. So it has some numbers and some symbols and some uppercase and lowercase in it. And so if it's a dictionary word password or if the password matches your username or something else, then that would be, I would be more concerned about that than I would of Google's or Yahoo's servers having a problem that allowed people to get into my email without my password.
Yeah, well, it was a real disaster because I talked to somebody that it happened to, and, you know, they went in and they actually changed their login the whole bit. I mean, it was just incredible.
I have not heard of any breach that allowed that to happen without knowing the user's username and password. The one that I saw the news on in the past was just being able to access and see other people's email. It was not have total control of their account. And I can't speak for Google or Microsoft's or any other except for Yahoo or Microsoft's web email services because I don't use them. But I do have Google services, and for some of their accounts, they allow for extra security so that it's an application you install on your smartphone. I know it's on Android and iOS and maybe for BlackBerry. And basically, when you first log in from a device, you have to type in your username, your password, and then you have to look on this application on your phone, and it gives you and it's called, I believe, the Google Authenticator, and it gives you a number, and that number changes every minute. It's a different number. Let me try to find it here. Oh, it's just called Authenticator, and it's a six-digit number, and so when I haven't logged in from a computer before, it says, okay, you need to give me your password, but now you need to give me your six-digit Google Authenticator number. And so nobody can steal, I mean, unless they steal my phone, they can't guess that password because it changes once a minute. So that if you're concerned about security and people getting into your account, find out if that's available for your account. Now, I have that on a Google Enterprise Applications account, and I'm not sure if it's available to regular Gmail users.
In terms of login, just I'm still at the basics. Do you do one that, in terms of, there's one that that you can, I guess, go to a site and it randomizes?
For passwords?
Yeah.
I use a random password for every website that I have an account on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I use a program called KeePass, which is an open source free program, KeePass. There are other ones out there. There's even one that, if you're affiliated with the university, that the university provides through the web store, through the site's web store. And then so every website I have an account on, I have an entry in that folder, in that program that has my username and the password and the URL for the website. And it generates random passwords for me, but there are also websites out there that can do that for you also. And, you know, if and then there's a master password that I have that's very long, and it's a passphrase. It's not a password. It's a long passphrase I use to open that master key file to get
to
all my passwords.
About 20 characters or something?
20 or 30,
yeah.
Right, with lowercase, uppercase, symbols, and numbers. But if we're, you know, the worst is I would rather have people, and somebody's going to call in and complain about this, I know, but this is the way I feel. I would rather have you have a piece of paper next to your desk at home with these random passwords written on it and these accounts for these websites than for you to have terrible passwords on websites that are on the internet. The reason for that is I am more concerned about bad actors that are connected to the internet and probing these websites than I am about somebody coming into your office at home and stealing that piece of paper. Now, would I prefer you have it encrypted on a USB key in one of these password keepers? Absolutely. But if the choice is using bad passwords and the same password for hundreds of websites, I would rather have you have a piece of paper next to your desk or taped to your monitor.
Yeah, I think that
I would say that doesn't go for work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Right.
No, at work because, yeah.
Other people walk into
the point
offices.
Is that they're actually targeting you at work, and if it's underneath your keyboard or whatever, then that's not a good thing. But for home, or even if you keep it in your wallet, or, you know, don't keep your ATM pin in your wallet, but for passwords to websites, and you don't have to necessarily even write down what website it's for. Mm-hmm. Let's say you print up a piece of paper or you go to the internet, you find a site that creates 20 random passwords for you, and you assign them, you know, letters A through whatever, or 1, 2, 3, 4, and you remember that that site uses password 4.
Yeah, were you the one that recommended in terms of on a flash drive? That's what I did. Is that I put the, the login on that one, and I just cut and paste.
That's how I have mine. So I use the KeePass Master Password program, but the database for that program is actually saved on a USB key that I keep in my pocket, except when I need it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I open up that program, and you right-click on it, and you say copy username, and I paste it into the web form. Then I say copy password, and I paste it into the web form. And the neat thing about KeePass is you can set it up to is that it is using copy and paste, so the password is, so to speak, in the clear in your paste buffer. But I have it automatically set that after 15 seconds of me saying copy password, it actually erases the paste buffer. So then it's not in there anymore. So I can't accidentally paste it a minute later into something else.
Yeah, I just eliminate that whole thing. Well, I appreciate it. And, I've been listening somewhat, you can tell. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. Other calls are invited, of course, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Speaking of security, you know, there was a company that had a big problem recently with credit card numbers being snatched. And apparently the issue wasn't personal information, but those credit card numbers.
Which is the silver lining to that cloud,
yeah.
That just credit card numbers.
Yeah.
Certainly. Even if credit card numbers, so stealing credit card numbers, the thieves actually know valid credit card numbers then. I don't know if we know whether it got the expiration date, which is the next piece of information you need to usually use a credit card unless it's presented. And maybe that's on the mag stripe, so it is used then too, credit card, I think that there are some brute force things out there where that they just try random, they know the range of what valid credit card numbers are,
mm-hmm.
and they possibly just try them. And I think, so even if there wasn't this theft, I urge people that they should probably log into their credit card website. I would think no less than once a week and look at the charges and actually go, yes, I recognize every one of those. I made every one of those. Now, the good thing is that in my experience, the credit card, the major credit card companies have been are very good, their security systems, at picking up the fact that why am I paying for a social membership in England, which was the last one that was on my credit card?
Or why did I buy gas in Urbana 10 minutes ago and in Texas 20 minutes
exactly.
ago?
Exactly. So that's been really good, that they're really good at picking up on what they consider abnormal use. Sometimes it's kind of a pain when they call you when you're, well, they cancel the card first, and then, or they shut off the card, and then they call you, and you're like, yeah, I'm on vacation. Thanks for making my credit card not work at the restaurant in Florida. You know, but that's better than, I think, the theft of the credit card. But I think logging in and checking your statement and actually paying attention and going, hey, I didn't do that, and calling up the credit card company, that you'll be okay then. And like I said, thank goodness no personal information was stolen, so hopefully that means no ID theft, because that is not something that I ever want to experience.
Okay. Well, now wouldn't you know it, we don't have a lot of time left, but we got a lot of calls and an email message. So first, let's take a call from a listener in Champaign, Line 1. Good morning.
Well, I can make mine real quick. Regarding the sheet by your computer with your password on it, I have a password-protected Excel file that only that is the only password that I have for that file. I mean, it's not used anywhere else, and I just keep all my passwords on the Excel sheet. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah,
so I do have one concern on that, and in the early days of password-protected documents, the password protection was more of a hindrance than something that people couldn't get past. So still, this is not bad, but if your machine was compromised and they got a hold of the copy of that file, I don't know how strong that encryption is on Excel anymore. So you still might consider going with a dedicated password keeper program.
Okay, let's take an email question now. I was using Norton 360 and now cannot see the other computers on my network, see the shared folders or shared drives. I'd like to keep using Norton. Do you know what happened and how can I see other computers?
I expect that the Norton firewall replaced the Windows firewall, and it's being a little too tight in what it's shutting off. Try to go in to the Windows firewall set or the Norton firewall settings and see if you can find the part for Windows file and print sharing. You can go to Norton, ask for support on that. And then the other option is to actually, which is my preference on my personal machines, is I trust the Windows firewall. I actually would remove the Norton firewall, leaving in the antivirus program and the anti-malware and things, but actually going back to using the Windows firewall.
Okay. Next, a listener in Normal on Line 4. Hello.
Hello. I have a computer that is on Gmail. You know, I have Gmail on my for my email, and that's basically what I want to use my computer for and have used it for. But now when I try to get into the to the email and use my password, it does not accept the password, and it never does. So I have to go through, they have those funny-looking letters you're supposed to do, which I don't understand why you're supposed to copy those. But anyway, you do those, you go through, you jump through many hoops. Takes me about 15 minutes where it finally will get back to my, you know, I've got a security code or word or whatever. It finally gets to that and asks me, and then asks me to give a new email email address. So I do, you know, or password. So I do, but then it doesn't remember it, and the next time I go through that whole thing again. And I'm not sure. I did have some more security put on it at a computer place, and I don't know if, and it's happened since then, I don't know if they just over-secured my computer or my email or what the problem is.
Are you setting it to the same password when you go through all those steps to retrieve the password and it asks for a new one to set it? Are you setting it to the same one that you think it should be every time, or a new one that you've made up?
No, I set it to a new one, and what it says, I have tried to set it to the old one, and it says you've used that one already or something like that, and it won't take it.
This is a tough one.
I've gone through many, many passwords because, you know, I've I just think of, I mean, it's really odd, you know.
I agree. I'm sorry, we just don't have a lot of ideas on this one. Perhaps going back to the computer store that you had work on it before and ask them to investigate.
Okay.
And see if the problem, I mean, so if legitimately the password is being changed on the Google account,
mm-hmm.
I have to think that somebody's doing that. And if it's not you, that's bad.
Right.
and that concerns me that there's something on your machine that somebody's able to steal the new password from your machine. If you were sending it to an older password, I'd be like, oh, there's somebody out there that has your old password, stop mm-hmm. using it. But since you're sending it to a different password every time, it's not that case. So honestly, I haven't run into this. And I think a tech helping you out, making sure, you know, maybe putting in a password, trying it out, and, you know, does it happen every day, or if you log
yeah.
out and come back 20 minutes later, does it do it again?
That I haven't tried.
So I'd be interested in
it. Would, the first time that I
sure. I think to help the computer staff out, if you take it to back to the store or whatever, the consulting firm, is to actually find out what is the how often will this happen?
Okay.
You know, is it as soon as you log out, you can't get back in? Mm-hmm. Is it 20 minutes? Is it 4 hours? How long is that? Because
okay.
that might help them, and especially if it's immediately, then that means it's easy to reproduce, and the consultant should be able to. It should help them greatly if they can do it while they're sitting there at the computer with you.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And there we'll have to wrap it up for the month of April. But we'll talk again about computers on May 3rd. That is the first Thursday of the merry month of May. And Jim and Debbie, are you in next month or is it going to be Peter? You guys are in, huh?
I'm pretty sure it's us
okay,
again.
Okay, very good. Anyway, there we will leave it. Debbie Flieger and Jim Irick are with the University of Illinois, and my thanks to them this morning for coming in and talking with us and taking calls and questions about computers.